nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Last few lectures, we have been talking about this concept of spin. And as I mentioned, the nearest thing in terms of things you have seen before that helps you understand spin is the polarization of light. But there are these subtle differences, and this difference between this theta and theta over 2 that we have talked about. Now, what I want to do today is kind of put this together and explain like how spin enters the Schrodinger equation, actually. We kind of worked on a small subset of it to understand the concept. And one of the important things I introduced in this context was these spin matrices. You know, there's a 3 of them, sigma x, which looks like this, sigma y, looks like this, and sigma z. Just let me just write it down here for reference. This will be drawing on it somewhat. Now, as I mentioned earlier, that in order to calculate the current voltage characteristics of any device, the basic method that we discussed back in February, based on this NEGF method, the input you need is a Hamiltonian, this H, and the sigmas, which tell you the coupling to the surroundings, the coupling to one contact, second contact, and the scattering. And I tried to emphasize there's a very important difference between the dynamical processes that are described by H and this connection to the surroundings. And that we'll talk more about actually later. Okay. So first point is how to write down the H, and that we have discussed that this is basically each of these things is a matrix, and the size of the matrix depends on how many points you need to represent your device. Although the starting point for H is usually the Schrodinger equation, which is a differential equation. And one of the concepts that I discussed one day was how a differential equation can be equivalently written as a matrix equation in principle. Right? And now in terms of matrices, one thing I had mentioned is that the only effect of spin is that the matrices become twice as big. Because it's like if you had a device with 3 points, now you'll have 6 points. Why? Because each point has now become like 2 things, an up component and a down component. Up and a down. That's kind of what happens here. Right? And so in terms of the mechanics of doing real calculations, it's just that every matrix is twice as big. But as I said, what we need to do is understand what all these things mean and the physical meaning behind these concepts, and that's what we are trying to do. But in terms of the mechanics of calculation, it's pretty straightforward in a way. You see, you just have to write down these matrices and then the same equations hold. Okay. Now, first question then is, like if you had a Schrodinger, if you start from the Schrodinger equation that I mentioned, and this is something you've seen often in various contexts, that IH bar d psi dt is equal to p square over 2m. And I write here, this is the potential energy, which I have written as q times v, except that the charge on an electron is negative. So I've written it as minus q times the potential. So if you have a positive potential, it results in a negative energy. It lowers the energy of electrons. So I wrote it this way. And this p here, that's actually this derivative operator, right? So it's a gradient operator rather. So P is minus IH bar grad. Now I put this tilde on top to indicate that this is this time independent Schrodinger equation. And as I mentioned, as long as nothing depends on time, you can write the time dependence as exponential minus I e t over h bar, kind of the same way that when you do circuits, you write e to the power j omega t for all the time varying quantities. Similarly, you can do something like this. And then this equation becomes this. I put this tilde to distinguish it from this one because this is a time-independent quantity, with the idea that this kind of time dependence is implied in the whole thing. Right? Okay. And most of the time, this is what we work with. Okay. Now, my question is that how does spin then enter this full Schrodinger equation? Okay. And what we discussed before, like the last couple of lectures, is that if, for example, you had a magnetic field in the z direction, let's say, then what you would have done is put something like this here. So it has these two components, the up component and the down component. So the point is that previously when we wrote the Schrodinger equation, the size had only one component. It was a scalar. Now we're thinking of psi as this spin or which has two components. So this itself you should sort of view as ih bar ddt of something with two components, you know, an up component and a down component. And here also, it's like an up component and a down component here. I'll just leave it alone. And what appears here then is, should be like a matrix, right? Matrix meaning you, and what it really is that up component is equal to this operator times the up component. The down is this operator times the down component. That would be the overall structure. So it should look something like this. Where so, in other words, if that magnetic field had not been there at all, then all we have done is taken a differential equation that looked like ih bar d psi dt equals h psi and turned it into two separate equations, as if we had ih bar d dt of psi up is h times psi up, ih bar ddt of psi down is h times psi down. No coupling. This is it. And then, of course, both those equations would have the same solutions, and that's why you don't bother to solve it twice. You just multiply by 2 at the end. That's the usual thing. Now, the place where you run into new issues is, of course, when the two components get coupled. Right? Now, if you put a magnetic field in the z direction, it doesn't exactly couple them, but it introduces a difference between them. Doesn't couple them in the sense there's no off-diagonal term. You can still solve the up and the down separately. But it does introduce a difference in the sense one of them has a higher energy than the other. Separate. Okay? Now, what I tried to explain last day is how this simple diagonal thing only works for BZ. Whereas if you had BX, for example, what would this be? This matrix? Right. So it would be actually this sigma x matrix. So when you have bz, you have the sigma z matrix. Bx, this one. By, that one. So you'd have something like this. Now this is getting a little more complicated in the sense the two things are getting coupled. And so if I had only one magnetic field in one direction, of course, the smart thing to do is call that direction z. That way, the equations are easiest to solve. Okay? But if you have magnetic fields in all kinds of all directions, then you don't quite have that luxury. Then you have to do it right. Okay. Now, the general way people write this part then, and this is just symbol, instead of all this, they would write mu b. That's the Bohr magneton. That's like, as I said, every electron is like a magnet, and that's the magnetic moment of one of those, right? Mu b. And all this is usually written as sigma dot b. So that's how they write this. Okay. What does this mean? Well, whatever's on top. That's the real meaning of this. In the sense that, you see, sigma dot b, so think of this as a dot product. When you have a dot product of two things, how do you write it? You write it as sigma x bx plus sigma y by plus sigma z bz. So, like any other dot product, you write it. Now, the part where it's different and tricky is that those sigma x, sigma y, sigma z themselves are 2x2 matrices. That's the thing. So, you write sigma dot b, that's a vector, but this is really a 2x2 matrix with three components. You see? That's the thing. So, this is a 2x2 matrix that looks like that. So, this really means 0, 1, 1, 0. This really means 0 minus I, I, 0. And that really means 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And so if you have a magnetic field in an arbitrary direction, then what will enter would be bx times this matrix, by times that, and bz times that, which basically, you know, is exactly what I'd written up here. So this is kind of like a compact way of writing this, the whole thing. Right? So what you'd usually see in the literature, what does this look like? Well, it looks like mu b sigma dot b. Right. Say this again? Yes. Thank you. So overall, this is how you now just take this off. Now, one thing I had mentioned before once is this, that the way magnetic field enters the Schrodinger equation, I mean, this is before we discussed spin. I had mentioned once that the way it enters this energy is that instead of P, you have P plus Q times A, where A is the vector potential. Because normally, you represent magnetic fields with a vector potential. And this, if you remember, we had done in an earlier different context, that when we were discussing cyclotron resonance and all that. Now, you might say, well, now we are putting it in a different way. Well, the thing is, these are two separate effects. And in general, you should have both of them. You see? So, last few days, I've been talking about this, kind of ignoring this part of the story, right? And then we said, well, let's think of a small thing which has just one level, so that H, these H's are just one level, you know, like epsilon, you know. So let's say that the 1s level of a hydrogen atom. So H is just a 1x1 matrix or something. In that case, we can just focus on a 2x2 thing and work out the situation. So we're looking at that case to understand what the meaning of this is. But in general, you see, the way it's supposed to work is, this is H, this is H, and this H actually should look like the following, P plus QA dot and then I had the QV, I believe. So overall, this is what is supposed to go in there. And so magnetic field sort of affects the electron in two ways. One is this what you call the Zeeman splitting, that the two spins go up and down. That's it. And this one is kind of what causes what you'd call the Lorentz force. That is, an electron is moving along in a magnetic field, it wants to bend in a certain direction. And again, what you learn in your freshman classes, this V cross B effect. Right? That's what. So if you are trying to understand Hall effect, this is usually the dominant thing. I mean, that's also there. It's just that at low fields, that's usually a very small separation. Okay. Now, one other point that's kind of related, but you know, some of you asked me last day, so I should mention this. This will come back to later. Is that when you put a sigma dot, let's say we put a magnetic field in the z direction, in that case, one energy goes up, the other one goes down. We discussed, and I tried to explain that what this means is that when I have a magnetic field in this direction, the spin wants to precess around that magnetic field, right? Keeping a constant angle to it, goes round and round. Now, some of you asked me, but in a magnetic field, you know, when you have these two, one energy has gone up and one energy has gone down, shouldn't the electron just go to the lower energy, which means after some time the electron should just be pointing in that direction? You see? Why are we talking about rotation? You see? And the thing is, again, here these are two separate things. As I've always said, as I'm often trying to stress, that what makes transport and all these problems hard is that these two things are kind of mixed up. That is, one is what you call dynamics, and the other is this thermodynamics part of it, of how things achieve equilibrium. Okay? And both those things have to be in a model, and in a way, this H is the dynamics, this is the thermodynamics. This is the part that connects you to the rest of the world and so on. Okay. So the thing is, what really happens is, if you put a magnetic field this way, the spin goes around it, and eventually in the long run, it points in the same direction. So it kind of goes round and round, and gradually gets, you know, falls into this direction. So it gradually gets damped. So it's sort of like a damped oscillator. And when you take the Schrodinger equation, it just tells you the oscillator part of it, the undamped part of it. And always when you are applying it to any real problem, you have to figure out some way of getting the damping into the story. And the same with a magnet any place, that when you put a magnetic field, experimentally people observe this. It's called the ferromagnetic resonance or electron spin resonance, single spins. There's a resonance, but it's damped. And eventually it is damped such that the electron would go into the lowest energy state. But that requires having a damping term in there, which requires more discussion, which will go. Okay. But right now we are just talking about the dynamics, which is that it just goes round and round. Okay. You had a question? Yes. Sigma cross B? Right, this will have to, so the point I'm coming to is the spin orbit interaction. That part looks a little bit like what you said. Right? We'll come to that. Okay. So, then the effect of a magnetic field on the Schrodinger equation then is, firstly, not a magnetic, I mean, first is, how do we include spin? Well, everything becomes 2 by 2. That's the basic point I mentioned before, that if you needed 3 points to represent the first component, now you need another 3 points for the second component, and so overall it's become twice as big. Okay. Differential equation-wise, it's now become kind of 2 coupled differential equations. There's an up and a down. Okay. And first thing that happens is, of course, you have the H. No couplings here. And then there is this extra coupling that we discussed. And so you could write overall this. H could be written as something like this times I. I meaning the identity matrix plus mu b sigma dot b. So I could overall write IH bar d dt of this two components psi. So let me write here psi. So this is the two component psi. IH bar d dt of this two component psi is equal to H. And this is now it has is a 2 by 2 matrix psi. And what's this H? Well, it's like this quantity times the identity matrix plus mu b sigma dot b. So this is how you'd often see it. Now, it takes a little bit of algebra to show this, but let me state this because it puts it in a slightly cleaner form. And that's this. So whatever we have written here, so actually for this discussion, let's forget the QV for the moment. So I'm thinking where to write this. So let me write it up here. Yeah. So P plus QA dot C. See, so these are the two things that we kind of introduced separately. One is the Zeeman part, and the other is this Lorentz force, right? Two kind of things separately. And what you can do is actually write those two things together as in this form. Now, that's not meant to be obvious. It takes a little bit of algebra to show that. But the nice thing about it is that it takes these two things that look kind of totally different and puts it in just one thing. So in that sense, makes it look a little more reasonable. See? That's it. Otherwise, you know, it looks so different here and here. But the thing is, by the way, I should put an I here to be consistent. So this is this identity matrix times that differential operator. This is this other thing we talked about, and all that could be lumped this way. That's the thing. Yeah.
Where does the four-dimensional
term go? Right. It would come out automatically. What I mean is, if we actually worked through this, the QH bar over 2M, you know, the Bohr magneton, the magnitude is QH bar over 2M, that would actually come out automatically. Now, yeah, let's see. I'm not sure I want to go through the full algebra, but let me at least do the simple one first, which is, what does this look like if there were no magnetic fields? Let's say A is zero. That's the easy one. So can you help me first with what does sigma dot, so what we are trying to figure out is, what does this look like? You know, what we really want is sigma dot p plus qa. But let's say, what does this one look like? Can you help me? Just so you get a feeling for. So I won't carry this 2m around. Let's just work on the matrix itself. So what does this matrix look like? You know, this is some matrix squared. But can you help me with what that matrix is? Remember, sigma dot p means pz times this guy plus px times this one plus py times that one. So when you write pz times this, you'll get pz here and minus pz there. Easy enough. And then there's a px times this plus py times this. So on the upper off diagonal, you get px minus ipy. So this multiplied by the same thing. So when I write sigma dot p, remember that's a 2x2 matrix with diff, and these p's are all differential operators, right? It's like ih bar ddz, etc. But it looks like pz, px minus py, and then this. Now if I multiply those two things, what do we get? Pz square plus the product of those two, which is px square plus py square. Is that it or anything else? The thing is, yeah, you might think that, well, you know, these are differential operators, may not commute. So what I mean by that is when I multiply this by this, I'll get I px py, whereas this will give me I minus I py px. And those may not cancel in general when you have operators, except that because px is derivative with respect to x and py is derivative with respect to y, you can always move them around. I mean, those are independent things. So this is it. You don't have anything else. Okay. Now, if you... So I think you'll get the same thing down here. Can you help me with the off diagonal? Zero. Yeah. Same here. So what you see is, you see the sigma dot p square is really just p square times I. I meaning the, you know, identity matrix. See? So what that means is that your usual Schrodinger equation, you know, if I were writing it, I had mentioned earlier that I h bar d dt of these two-component spinner was equal to, you know, p square, 0, 0, 1 over 2m times this. And then I guess I had the qv minus qv times this. So this was the potential energy term, but this is the... And this part, I could just as well have written as sigma dot p square. That's the thing. Okay. So I could have written this part simply as sigma dot p square over 2m times this. And then one can say that the real, the, how does magnetic field enter this? Well, you just replace P with P plus QA. And then you get sigma dot P plus QA. And then with some algebra, you can show that that is actually the same as this. It is as if you had put a P plus QA in this one part and then had this Zeeman term that we discussed, the mu B sigma dot B. It's all kind, it then kind of looks like part of the same story. That all you are really doing is putting a P plus QA. Okay. So overall then the story just becomes sigma dot P plus QA. This is it. Now, this one, as I said, takes a little algebra. The basic idea is that you see, if I had sigma dot p plus qa here, and I'm trying to find the square of that, then what would have happened is here, instead of getting pz, I'd have got plus qaz also. Similarly, instead of px minus py, I'd have plus a. I guess QAX minus QAY. You'd have things like this. Okay? And then when you multiply it out, the off-diagonal terms wouldn't quite cancel. Why is that? Because of this operator issue that now you'll have things like PX acting on some function here, AX, whereas in the other case it will not be. The AX will be first and the PX will come later, and that's what takes a little algebra to sort out. But at the end of it, you would find that what you get here would be this, you know, whatever you would get from this term. And this QH bar over 2M would come out automatically. This kind of takes a little algebra. I'm not going through that. But, yeah. But the point is that this whole thing can be written in this way. And this is what is known as the Pauli equation, or sometimes people call the Schrodinger-Pauli equation. Because the original equation was the Schrodinger equation. And this includes spin into the story in the presence of a magnetic field, complete thing. Right? Now, what complicates this story a little more is this, that, yeah, this is what you'd call the non-relativistic equation, In other words, you know, Schrodinger equation was to start with non-relativistic. It was based on, let me just write this here, the idea that, you know, if you start with something like E equals P square over 2M plus, you know, this QV, I guess I've been writing this minus Q because charge on the electron is Q. Okay, but the thing is that you start from this energy relationship and then replace E with IH bar DDT and replace P with minus IH bar del. That's the usual prescription for how you turn the simple energy momentum relation into a wave equation, right? And the wave equation then, as we have discussed, if you have constant coefficients, will have a dispersion relation looking just like that. Right? That's the basic starting point usually. Okay. Now, this is the non-relativistic energy momentum relation. Now, for this discussion for the moment, let's just drop this. The important thing is this energy momentum relation here, E versus B, and the general relation, relativistically correct relation, is this one. Okay. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that for many, to understand many phenomena in solids, actually, this isn't quite enough. You actually need a correction term here, which is a relativistic correction term. And that is that spin-orbit interaction that I want to get to. Right? That's that extra term that comes in. That's a relativistic correction. And ordinarily, you might have thought that, you know, relativity only matters when things are moving at very high speeds. And after all, here, nothing's moving at very high speeds. But the fact is, there are very clear observable effects that really depend on having this spin-orbit interaction. And the reason relativistic effects get important, I guess roughly the idea is that right close to the nucleus, the electric fields are enormously high. And high enough to actually lead to these effects. And these effects, of course, were identified back in the 1930s and 40s when people were studying atomic spectra. And they again found that to understand the spectra, these corrections actually had to be included. I mean, it's not so important in hydrogen, but as you go to heavier atoms with larger nucleus, these things show up in a much clearer way. Anyway, so now the relativistic equation, the problem was, you know, how do we write a differential equation that would correspond to that one? Because after all, you know, if you just take this, you'll get E equals square root of this. Right? You could put a plus minus. And if you just follow this prescription, yeah, you could put that in and you'd get a del square there. But then what does the square root of del square, what exactly is that differential equation? That is the problem. And this is where Dirac found a remarkably elegant solution. And that is, and that's this Dirac equation. That his question is, if I am trying to write the square root operator, you see, so I'm trying to write a differential equation for, say, I h bar d psi dt equals, I'd like to write some h psi, and that h should be the square root of this. You see, so something that will look like, you know, the p is like del square, as you know, h bar square del square. So something that would look like this. So how do I write something so that multiplied by itself, it would give me this? And what he figured out was a way to write a matrix. He said that, you know, what I can write is a 4x4 matrix like this, such that when I multiply it by itself, it will give me this quantity times I. So in other words, he figured out a nice clean way of writing a 4x4 matrix like this, such that that matrix could be interpreted as square root of this times I, the identity matrix, in the sense that this matrix multiplied by itself is equal to that number times the 4x4 identity matrix. Okay? Now, what was this matrix? Well, it looks something like this. MC square times I. Now, this I is just a 2 by 2 I. You know, this whole thing is 4 by 4. So I'm trying to write the different 2 by 2 parts of it. So this one is MC squared times I guess. This is a different I. I'll just put an I4 to remind you that that's a 4 by 4 I. Okay. This is a 2 by 2 I. Here you have sigma dot P. Here you have sigma dot P. And here you have minus MC squared I. That's it. So this is the famous Dirac equation. You see? Dirac equation without the scalar potential. If you want to put in the scalar potential, it would just be minus QV times psi. That's it. So this is what the Dirac equation looks like. And the thing is, it corresponds to having a energy momentum. If you calculated its dispersion relation, it would look like that. And that would then correspond to a relativistic particle of that type. Okay. Now, let's check this out quickly. So if I take MC squared I sigma dot P minus MC squared I, and then multiply it by itself, what do we get? Actually, I missed a C here. C meaning, of course, speed of light. There should be a C there. Otherwise, it wouldn't be dimensionally correct. Okay. So what do we get? First, when I multiply these two, I get m squared c to the power 4. And then I get sigma dot p times sigma dot p, which I just proved to you is a p squared times I. Okay? So what you really get is plus c squared p squared. All of this times I, meaning a 2 by 2 matrix. And you'll get exactly the same thing here. Now, can you help me with what goes here? Zero. So you see, he had managed to write down an operator such that multiplied by itself, it gives you a number times an identity operator. Times an identity, basically. You see? So he had, in a way, managed to write down an operator that would be the square root of this. Right. So what would happen is that if you found the EK relationship corresponding to this, what you'd see is something like this. So this is E versus, you know, P or K, whatever you like, the way you correspond usually. And what you'd find is that the relationship would be given by E is equal to plus minus square root of m squared c to the power 4 plus c squared p squared. So there'd be a whole bunch of things here, whole bunch of things here, like that. And can you help me with what this point is? MC square, right? So it's plus MC square. This is minus MC square, right? And MC square, you can put in the numbers for electron. M, if you use the M for electron, that would come to, I think, about 500,000 electron volts. So, you know, normally in this business, when you're talking of solids, energies are maximum, say, 10 volts. You're talking of 10 electron volts, nothing more than that usually, right? But this thing here is like million electron volts. Okay? As I said, 500,000 electron volts this way, another half this way. Okay? Okay. So you do have a positive set and a negative set. Okay. So the usual Schrodinger equation that we work with, that describes this. Oh, by the way, as you said, there will be four values. Four because there will be two of them right here, which are degenerate. Those were what you call the upspin and the downspin. Same two down here, upspin and a downspin. And the Schrodinger equation basically describes this part of it. Okay? And the physical picture people have in mind, and this is again very counterintuitive. When Dirac first, you know, when this first came up, it was a major puzzle, took some time for people to get convinced that it actually describes reality. The picture people have is, when you have a vacuum with just nothing, that corresponds to all these states being filled with something, whatever it is. Right? All of this is filled, and all these are empty. That's vacuum. Okay? And since these are filled, it's kind of like the valence band of your solid. And as long as they're filled, you don't even notice it. This is what really does everything. Now, what that means, of course, is that if you hit this with some very high energy particles whose energy is more than 1,000,000 electron volts, then you could create holes here and put them out there. And at that time, of course, there was no experimental evidence for this, except that within a few years, people actually observed this. You see, and this hole then is the positron, that's the electron. So you, by hitting it with 1,000,000 volts, you can create electron-positron pairs. And that's an experimental fact. I mean, these are things that are, these are real experiments that people do routinely these days, actually. Right? So indeed, yeah, so vacuum consists of this whole thing being filled. And then when you hit it with a 1,000,000 electron volts, this is what would happen. In solids, normally we don't worry about it because we normally aren't thinking of anything with 1,000,000 electron volts, usually, right? That involves, you know, higher energy particles. Whereas most chemical reactions, most everyday phenomena are electron volt, 10 electron volt type of phenomena. You see, where you usually don't have to worry about this. So what you need is a good description of this part. And the Schrodinger equation is a good approximation to it to start with, but then there are some relativistic corrections to it. And roughly speaking, the correction we are talking about is the following. You see, usually you write E equals P square over 2m. That's what we're used to. Question is, how do I get from this to this? Now, this is the non-relativistic relation. That's the relativistic relation. How do you get from here to here? Well, what you do is use this binomial expansion. The idea is we are talking of non-relativistic particles means this is much smaller than that. You know, this is this half a million electron volt part of it. This is much smaller than that. In which case, what you can do is pull mc square out of the thing. And inside, you could write it as square root of 1 plus p square divided by m squared c square. Think so, right? Did I do it right? So I'm pulling m squared c to the power 4 out of it. So I have to divide this by m squared c to the power 4, and that amounts to this. And then we argue that this is very small. So 1 plus x, when I take the square root, I could write 1 plus half x. That's this binomial expansion. So you could take this square root out and put 1 plus half x. Okay, so that now is approximately true. And that then would become mc square plus p square over 2m. And Schrodinger equation then is for the p square over 2m part. The mc square, that's a constant you don't worry about. That's a constant energy, yeah. Say this again. Totally different issues, right? Totally different things. So this is like what happens in vacuum. Right? So this is like, and the very counterintuitive part is that even when there's nothing there, the picture we have is that this is all filled. Right? That's it. Okay. On the other hand, when you are talking about solids, that's of course a very real thing. You know, this is valence band, that's, we understand. And that split off isn't quite related to this at all. It would really be something that would come out of this. So what we are trying to do here is, as I said, if you were using the full Schrodinger equation, it would have looked the full Dirac equation that is relativistically correct, it would look something like this. And what people go through some algebra to show is that from here, you can go to the Pauli equation if you do something that's kind of the equivalent of this binomial expansion, basically. It's a little more complicated because operators are involved. But in essence, it's something like this. That's what you'd have to do to get here. And there, if you go to the next higher order, then you get another correction term, which is what is the spin-orbit interaction. And the spin-orbit interaction essentially looks something like this. It is like mu b sigma dot electric field cross p over 2mc square. So this is this extra term that would come in if you went to the next higher order. What I mean by that is, you see, you're taking square root of 1 plus x and calling it 1 plus half x. But as you know, there's a next term that's like x square. You could have 1 plus half x and then kept another term which would have given like p to the power 4th. And if you do the equivalent of this, and the algebra is, you know, non-trivial, and I'm not going through it because it's not directly relevant to what we'll be doing also. But the point is, this is the origin of the spin orbit term. That back in the 1930s and 40s, when people were trying to understand just atomic spectra, they realized that Schrodinger equation wasn't enough. There were things they were seeing in the spectra of heavy atoms that actually required them to include this. You see? And the same thing has to be included in dealing with, say, gallium arsenide or any of these semiconductors. I mean, the essential effect is just an atomic effect. It's just that in gallium and arsenic itself, the S and P levels of the atoms are not quite like that, but they're somewhat mixed up because of this term. And it has a very direct experimental consequence in the sense that, you know, I usually restrict myself to talking about the conduction band. Because for the conduction band, you know, we usually, our starting point, I've often said, is this Schrodinger equation. But you realize, of course, that it's not the real Schrodinger equation. We are using an effective mass equation. We say that, well, electrons going through a solid kind of look as if they're going through vacuum, but with a different mass. Right? That's the equation we are normally used. So in a way, Schrodinger equation in vacuum is not very relevant to what we are trying to do usually in solids. What we need is an effective mass equation. And there also, the reason I'm discussing all this is, effective mass equation of an electron in a conduction band, you know, looks sort of like this. Instead of m, you have this m star. And the thing is, you also pick up terms like this, the correct effective mass equation in solids for the conduction band. For the valence band, it's actually more complicated, which is why I usually avoid saying much about the valence band. The conduction band is kind of relatively easier to understand, right? And one of the very remarkable facts, this is that, you know, when you draw conduction band and valence band, things like this, you know, this is the EK relationship. This should not be confused with that, right? This was the picture for vacuum. This is a 1 million volts in between. Here we are talking about a solid. So all this is part of just the upper branch here. Right? It's that upper branch in a solid, what happens? That's what gives rise to things like this. And ordinarily, you know, this level is kind of like the S level of solids, of atoms. You know, so if it is silicon, this might be like the 2S or 3S level. No one of them. The 3S level. And these are like the 3P levels, let's say. Or, you know, so S and P levels. Now, the thing is, because of this spin-orbit interaction that you always have in all these atoms, these levels are somewhat more complicated, where upspins and downspins are all mixed up. So if there were no spin-orbit interaction and no magnetic field, you would have said that, well, you know, up and down are just two separate things. I'll just multiply by 2 at the end. Done. Don't have to worry about much. But because of the spin orbit interaction, even though there is no magnetic field, and sometimes people say, well, what really happens is in a high electric field, an electron sees an effective magnetic field due to relativistic effects. You know, because after all, this is a relativistic term, as you know. And they say, well, there's an effective magnetic field that's that big, that's like that, that comes from relativistic effects, and it manifests itself when electric fields are huge, as it is near the nucleus. Okay. Anyway, the net result is that these are not pure px, py states, it's a, but combinations of various up and down spins. And this has a very clear effect that one can observe in the laboratory routinely. And that is that if you inject up spins into the conduction band, and when it emits light, you'd expect that the light would be unpolarized ordinarily. But the thing is, if you just inject up spins preferentially, the light that comes out would be circularly polarized. And circularly polarized because of this very special nature of the valence band, which comes from having a spin orbit interaction term. Okay? And this is a routine experiment that nowadays that's routine, that people use to detect whether their device has any extra up spins compared to down spins. Because what happens is up spins would emit, say, left circularly polarized light. Down spins would emit, say, right circularly polarized light. And if you have equal numbers of both, you'd just see unpolarized light. But if it is, say, circularly polarized in one direction, that tells you have managed to get more up spins in there than down spins. And in materials like gallium arsenide, which are optically, you know, which emit light easily, this is one of the most common ways that people use to detect whether they actually have more of one spin than another. See? And one of the reasons there's a lot more experiments on spin-related experiments on gallium arsenide than on silicon is because in silicon you don't quite have this, because silicon doesn't emit light because it's this indirect gap semiconductor. It doesn't emit light quite so easily. Though these days, people have been able to do that as well. Okay? Anyway, but the point I wanted to stress here then is that, you know, when you go through this much math again, you always wonder whether what you're doing has any connection with reality. And it's always kind of amazing to see that, you see, this has a very direct consequence. This relativistic correction has a very direct consequence, namely, the solid actually emits circularly polarized light instead of unpolarized light because of a relativistic effect. Yeah, let me stop here today. Okay.